However, the Albanian government, the U.S. embassy in Albania, and Rajavi itself, they keep their members close in the camp. They blackmail and threaten them, and they do not let them to.
Excuse me. Let me just follow up on this. This is exactly the. We've come to a good point. So basically, what we can then conclude, because, of course, you are a historian. You teach history at the Islamic University in Malaysia. So let's try to reach a conclusion from this. So basically, the Americans, at some point in the early 2000s, decided that they need an Islamic country to serve as a base to be able to infiltrate, be able to operate within the Muslim world. And Albania seemed to be the best one because it was in Europe. There was a history of the history that you explained. There was a what in political science would be called a kleptocracy, a rule of the thieves, being which would allow them to infiltrate much easier and influence them much easier than many other countries where the rulers or the leaders might have to answer to the people actually in terms of what they do. So what we see now is, as you very nicely pointed out, that the two major countries in West Asia, the two ancient but also the new rising Muslim powers, one Sunni, one Shia, Turkey and Iran, who, according to the former head of the MI6, he said that the future of West Asia is Iran and Turkey, that those countries like Saudi Arabia, which are based on oil, they don't really have a future. But you have two countries which have an ancient history and are capable of actually being strong, powerful countries leading the Muslim Ummah. We have now the Americans setting up shop in Albania, bringing these extremists, these cults, these people who are brainwashed, in order to use them against these two countries. So this is very interesting. We also have to note here, this is maybe something that very few people know, the fascist party in Spain, the Vox party in Spain, officially was sponsored by the Rajavi cult, that they received money for their elections. Of course, this was the money that Saudi Arabia was channeling to them, to the fascist party in Spain, but it did it through the Rajavi cult. This is another interesting thing. So we can also say that one of the functions of the Rajavi cult in Europe is to funnel Saudi money to whoever needs to be funneled to without that the public realizing that it's Saudi money. So I want to go back, with your permission, to this idea of a kleptocracy, this idea of the country basically being very closely connected, the government of the country, the leadership, being closely connected to organized crime. Albania is actually a country that produces oil. This is something that very few people know. It actually is an oil-producing country. But from what I was reading in your articles, the Albanian people are not seeing any of that oil. Could you, very briefly, because we don't have much time left, very briefly explain to us what is happening to Albania's oil? Who's getting the profits?
Well, Albania is an oil producing country which doesn't have oil for its people, and we are forced to export oil from outside. Albania produces in a year, I think, around 1 million tons of oil, but all our oil is being taken for zero money in return by an American-Canadian company called Bankers Petroleum, which is headed by the ex-general of NATO who bombed Yugoslavia, Wesley Clark. This company, which takes our oil and gives nothing to Albania in return, is being protected by U.S. government itself. In 2017, because Bankers Petroleum, they use fracking in Albania, they destroyed a town known as Marinza, where they caused a huge explosion because of the fracking they were doing. And in that time, Albania's prosecutor general wanted to open a criminal case against this company, which evades and pays no tax and takes all the oil out of the country. And when the general did this thing, he was blackmailed by a U.S. ambassador in Albania, who now works for the State Department, Donald Liu. And the prosecutor general was removed from his job, and later he was charged for not declaring his properties. So we have almost the same situation like in Ukraine, where Joe Biden and U.S. administration went against the prosecutor general of Ukraine, who wanted to make charges against Biden and a number of American oligarchs. So in Albania, we live in a jungle-like when it comes to U.S. interests. And coming back to the Mujahideens, if I may clarify this, Mujahideens are kept in Albania because Israeli Mossad needs them. They are, in a way, used by Mossad to attack Iran, to create as much as possible enmity and fake news about Iran in Europe. And during the era of the Trump administration, for people who have followed my articles, they even created a number of so-called fake terrorist incidents in Europe where they were blaming Iran. The reason was that the Israeli government is fighting a proxy war with Iran in Europe. That was the time when Iran was still in the nuclear deal and Israelis played every card they could in order to scare the Europeans. And the attacks of the Mujahideens of or the Munafikins, how you call them, against Iran, culminated in March 2018 when they claimed, make a fake claim, as if Iran wanted to make a terrorist act in Albania. Me and my colleagues who are journalists, we proved that this was a fake news. But this fake news, which was taken by American medias like Fox News and others, was used as a justification to boot out of Albania the Iranian ambassador.
Exactly.
So coming back to the system in Albania nowadays is, even though in appearance country looks to be European, open and free, the situation is very much similar to what happens in Ukraine under Zelensky, where you have gangs that rule, and on the top of the gangs, you have the U.S. Embassy.
Doctor, okay, so we had some very heavy issues that we were discussing, and it seems that the present is a little, you know, heavy and depressing, but what I want to ask you is about the future. Are there people in Albania who are more nationalist-minded, who are maybe more willing to implement policies and govern the country in a way that's more in favor of the interests of the Albanian people, that is maybe, you know, going in the direction of establishing those links again with the Muslim world, whether it's Turkey or Iran or the Arab countries. How do you see the future? Is there hope for the future?
Albanians were the most pro-American people in Eastern Europe and in Balkans during the last decades. And this was because the Americans helped the Albanians during the Yugoslav conflict with a NATO intervention in 1999 on behalf of Kosovo. However, in the last decade, American policies towards the Albanians have changed a lot, especially during the Trump administration. We have the top leadership of the Albanians, from the president of Kosovo to the head of the parliament, who have been jailed in The Hague with the blessing of the Americans. And also in Albania, the Americans, they are attacking our president and our ex-president and prime minister and head of the opposition. There is an open rebellion against Americanism in Albania in particular, but even in neighboring Kosovo. Even though the situation now seems gloomy, like it is in Ukraine with the Zelenskys that the Americans have installed in power, I think there is hope for Albania. We have to keep in mind that majority of Albanians are Muslim. We are Sunni and we are Shia as well. And the historical connections that Albania had and has with the Muslim Ummah, with Turkey and Iran, cannot be outdone by terrorist groups like the Gulenists and the Munafikins. So there is hope for Albania, and I would like to appeal to the Muslim Ummah not to forget Albania. After all, Albania is the oldest and the only fully recognized Muslim-majority country in Europe. We are Europeans, and the presence of Islam in Albania cannot be outdone by the Americans. In the last decade, the Americans are trying to squeeze and destroy the influence of Turkey, Iran, but even of Arab countries in Albania. Nevertheless, they cannot outdo Islam. As we see now, the situation with the defeat of NATO in Ukraine and with the rising of Russia and the end of the unipolar world where only Americans would dictate to the rest of the planet, I think, yes, there is hope for Albania. Albanian Muslims will re-establish their connections with the Muslim Ummah, and they will not allow their country to be used as a base against Islam. The presence of the Gulenists, but even of the Mujahideens, is very much hated in the country. Even the kleptocratic system that the Americans have installed is hated, and I think that the change will come sooner or later.
Dr. Yazici, thank you so much for joining us. This was a very important subject, I think, which, you know, it's like adding insult to injury. All these things happening in Albania, but also the media not covering it. So we were trying to shed light and give some insight to our audience about this very important part of the Muslim world and of Europe, this unique place where Europe and Islam are come together. And thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for giving us insight on this issue.
Thank you for having me.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Yazici? We learned that Albania is the only Muslim-majority nation in Europe, with approximately 70% of the population declaring their adherence to this religion. This fact is precisely the reason that the U.S., European nations and Israel have been particularly sensitive about Albania establishing close relations with other Muslim nations such as Iran, Turkey, or Saudi Arabia. Following the collapse of communism in the 1990s, there was a concerted effort by the US and its vassals to occupy Albania and the Albanian majority region of Kosovo in order to first strategically deny this Muslim majority nation and region to the Muslim Ummah and Muslim nations such as Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia, with the usual fake excuse of fighting Islamic terrorism. Secondly, to use it as a platform and base for operations against Muslim countries such as Iran, Turkey, and other Arab countries by using a Muslim facade and establishing various terrorist cults and deviant sects who have declared war against the legitimate governments of some Muslim nations in Albania, in a policy that Dr. Yazici called turning Albania into Europe's garbage can. Thirdly, to weaponize legitimate Albanian nationalist feelings against Serbia and Russia, and in this way use Albania and Kosovo as a NATO base against Russia in Eastern Europe. In pursuit of these strategies, the U.S. has bought and captured Albanian elites and has produced what Dr. Yazici has called our own little Zelenskys, in reference to the pro-Western Ukrainian leader elites, who are basically just the executors of policies determined by the U.S. Embassy and the Soros Foundation. As usual, America is its own worst enemy in the countries it tries to control by propping up corrupt leaders who eliminate peaceful political opponents and abuse human rights. And so we see the same pattern in Albania as we have seen in so many other Muslim nations, where the U.S. supports corrupt and abusive elites, which results in turning the people of that nation against anything and anybody that has anything to do with the United States. Just like the atheist communist dictatorship failed over decades to extinguish the light of Islam and the connection of the Albanians with their fellow Muslim brethren of the Ummah, so too is the current U.S.-Israeli strategy to de-Islamize and weaponize Albania for their own strategic goals doomed to failure, because it is contrary to the deep-held religious beliefs and national interests of the Albanian people. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on May 7th, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the International Al-Quds Day. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in his speech on the occasion of International Quds Day, referring to the change in the balance of power in favor of Islamic world and Palestine, emphasized, I tell you with confidence the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and will not stop.
Another noteworthy point is that although that the usurping regime was established in 1948, the ground for occupying that sensitive Islamic region had been prepared years before that. Those specific years coincided with the active interference of Westerners in Islamic countries with the purpose of establishing secularism, an excessive and blind nationalism, and also with the goal of installing despotic governments who were infatuated with or controlled by the West. Studying those events in Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries, stretching from West Asia to North Africa, reveals this bitter truth that weakness and discord in the Islamic Ummah paved the way for the disastrous usurpation of Palestine, allowing the world of arrogance to deliver that blow to the Islamic Ummah.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
It is instructive that at that time, the capitalism and communism camps colluded with the rich Zionists. It was the English who masterminded the plot and who persisted in it, and then Zionist capitalists executed it with their money and weapons. The Soviet Union, too, was one of the first governments that officially recognized the establishment of that illegitimate regime, and later on dispatched a large number of Jews to that area. The usurping regime was actually an outcome of that situation in the world of Islam, on the one hand, and of a European plot, invasion and transgression on the other. Today, the situation in the world is not like those days. We should keep this reality within sight. Today, the balance of power has swung in favor of the world of Islam. Various political and social incidents in Europe and in the United States have laid bare the weaknesses and the deep structural, managerial and moral conflicts among Westerners.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A senior Israeli official has traveled to the Saudi capital and met inside the royal palace with a high-ranking Saudi official. According to Israel's Channel 12, the visit was meant to coordinate security cooperation between the two sides, which included the alleged common threats posed by Iran. The visit was linked to the two sides' mutual interest in leveling up their relations. In March, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said, "Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy, but looks to it as a potential ally," saying they have many interests that can pursue together. Riyadh and Tel Aviv have no formal diplomatic relations, although it is widely believed that they do have contacts behind the scenes. There are plenty of examples of this. In 2018, it was reported that the chief of staff of the Israeli army met his Saudi counterpart to discuss terrorism and the alleged threat from Iran. Saudi Arabia's decision to allow Air India flights to and from Tel Aviv to transit through Saudi airspace are tangible signs of a shift. When bin Salman was asked about Israel having a say on stolen Palestinian land, he said he believes that the Jewish people have a right to a nation-state in at least part of their ancestral homeland. U.S. President Joe Biden is going to travel to the occupied Palestinian territories. Biden administration officials are in talks with the Saudis about arranging a potential in-person meeting between Biden and the Saudi prince for the first time. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's advisor Eyal Hulata is expected to travel to the U.S. next week. Earlier this week, two senior U.S. officials reportedly visited Riyadh as the Biden administration is quietly mediating a Red Sea deal between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt that involves the transfer of two strategic islands, Tiran and Sanafir, in the Red Sea from Egyptian to Saudi sovereignty with Israeli consent. The deal could also pave the way for the official announcement of the normalization of ties between Riyadh and Tel Aviv. When asked about the report, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan refused to deny it, only saying more steps needed to be taken to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In 2020, Israel's then Premier Benjamin Netanyahu visited Riyadh and met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. This year saw Washington brokering normalization of relations between the Israeli regime and some Arab states, including United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, Saudi Arabia's key Arab allies in the region. The trend of normalization has been roundly condemned by Palestinians as a brazen betrayal of their cause. Israel and Saudi Arabia have for years been conducting covert talks on diplomatic, security, and business affairs, and now Washington is trying to improve ties with Riyadh. U.S. officials are even seeking to organize a meeting between Biden and the Saudi crown prince. This comes against the backdrop of the global energy crisis caused by the war in Ukraine. Russia-Ukraine conflict continues to rock the global energy market. The U.S. is finding itself increasingly reliant on Saudi Arabia, the world's largest crude oil exporter.
A Zionist entity like Israel, I can't really call them a country because they're not. Palestine is the legitimate country. Israel has usurped and stolen the land. So I would caution any nation. I look at what Israel has done to the United States, how they have infiltrated and use the Jewish population in the U.S. to influence our foreign policy in a manner that is no longer favorable to the American people, but instead is favorable to the government of Israel.
Saudi Arabia has refrained from normalizing ties with Israel, unlike Bahrain and UAE, saying it would not do so without a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But bin Salman calling Tel Aviv a potential ally could indicate that Riyadh has already betrayed the Palestinian cause, and admitting it overtly is only a matter of time.
The U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack.
I was just devastated. It's heart-rending for us as grandparents We have children in the age vicinity that happened here. It's overwhelming.
In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed.
Why are you here? If not to solve a problem as existential as this. This isn't inevitable. These kids weren't unlucky. This only happens in this country and nowhere else. Nowhere else do little kids go to school thinking that they might be shot that day.
The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York.
So to me, it's really two factors. It's troubled kids, troubled young people, and guns. And every country has troubled young people to some extent, but not every country has a system where you can get guns so easily.
The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people.
The Republican Party, the Democratic Party, can't say anything about it because the colonial mode of production, the violence that's required by the colonial mode of production is what keeps, is the lifeblood for the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society.
So, no, there is no irony that the biggest purveyor of colonial violence is also the biggest supplier of guns. That's why they have hundreds of military installations. They, being the United States, has hundreds of military installations around the world. Army, Air Force, Marines, and the Coast Guard, whatever else they have. And even in within the United States borders, the police department, sheriff department, the marshals, all those instruments of violence exist.
The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
Tom?
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations. U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
the U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack. In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed. The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York. The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people. That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society. The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program.
As a reminder, we spoke about the events which led to Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by the notorious organization SAVAK. As you know, we tried to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. This time, you will hear on the events after the Imam's arrest, particularly the historical uprising of June 5th, 1963. Stay with us, please. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest was like a big blast in the country, as the people of Qom, Tehran, and other cities poured to the streets to protest against the Pahlavi regime's move. The demonstrators chanted slogans like "Death to the Shah" and "Either Death or Khomeini." In the holy city of Qom, people swarmed around the Imam's house and chanted anti-regime slogans. The tyrannical regime, in order to intimidate the people, flew military planes over the city, but angry people became more persistent in their move and called for unconditional release of their great leader and source of emulation. The agents of the Shah, scared of the spread of anti-regime sentiments, opened fire and massacred hundreds of people. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest caused people from all walks of life to demonstrate across the city. University students closed their classes and poured to the campuses in protest. Owners of different occupations in bazaar closed their shops and poured to the streets. Students spread their rallies to the streets and joined the people, demanding the Imam's immediate liberation. The regime security and police forces tried to control the city by cannons and tanks. In Tehran, too, hundreds of people were massacred by the bullets of the mercenaries of the Shah. In the evening of June 5, 1963, Tehran was plunged in silence. Trucks were gathering the bodies of martyrs to take them to cemeteries. The whole city was full of soldiers to suppress any protest. The people in the small city of Peshwa near Varamil in southeast of Tehran created a great epic as they heard the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest. These people, most of whom were farmers, started marching over 20 kilometers toward Tehran while they were wearing their shrouds as a sign of preparedness for death. They chanted slogans like, "Khomeini, Khomeini, you are the son of Hussein. Either death or Khomeini," and "Death to the Shah." Moreover, the people of regional villages joined the marchers and shaped great masses in Varamin. Thus, the people of Varamin also joined the demonstration marching toward Tehran. Almost at sunset, they faced the military squads of the tyrannical regime, Bagherabad village. Seeing the stiff resistance of the people, the military forces cruelly massacred thousands of innocent people and injured thousands of others. People in Qom had gathered around the Imam's house. The Imam's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, relates, "The sound of either death or Khomeini and Khomeini, Khomeini, may God guard you, may your bloodthirsty enemy be dead," had filled our home. The sound came from the street, but it seemed to come from behind the door. Our home was the venue of ladies. They would come and faint. I would put their heads in my lap and restore their health with water and juice. They were the wives of the poor seminary students and classes who really loved the Imam. Imam Khomeini's wife, referring to the taunting of a few women affiliated to the regime, continues, "But at the same time, some women would come and break our hearts with pungent remarks, yet we had decided to keep calm." Comparing the women who would faint with those who would taunt us was the comparison of poverty and courage with richness and compromise. Imam Khomeini's wife points to the horrible atmosphere of Qom and the regime's flying of military planes over the city on June 5th, saying, "On June 5th, the regime had ordered phantom planes to fly over Qom to intimidate people. Women and men in Qom had become scared of breaking the sonic wall in the city. It seemed that the planes would fly low when they reached our house. They would maneuver with queer speed over the city, and this would deteriorate the condition of most women in our house. So I and my daughters would give them juice. They had come to soothe us, but it was we who were soothing them." Lady Saqafi continues on the self-sacrifice and resistance of people in those days. "People went on a stiff strike and closed all shops for 15 days. At last, the government forced the people to open their jobs and shops through intimidation and burning some shops and demolishing big stores. Of course, upon my elder son Mustafa's opinion and permission, bakeries and butcheries opened for a few hours in the first days to meet people's needs. Fruits had gone bad in shops, but nobody would open. Honestly, people showed high self-sacrifice and resistance." She continues, "Near the sunset, there was a rumor of attacking our house at night to captivate women. This rumor made men think over replacing us. Mr. Ishraqi and Mustafa asked for replacement. I told them, 'Are you scared?' They said, 'We have heard so.' I said, 'It is false. I won't leave this house. I am ready for captivity, but not escape.' I resisted, but Mustafa was anxious and angry. So I accepted unwillingly. We went to Mr. Ishraqi's house. God knows how it was hard for me, but I tolerated. We went and came back the day after to see that I was right."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Some 30,000 Israeli settlers marched through Al-Quds and its old town while chanting anti-Arab
and anti-Muslim slogans as part of what's known by Israel as the Flag March that takes place annually to celebrate its occupation of the eastern parts of the Holy City in 1967. Thousands also marched through the Muslim quarter of the old town of Al-Quds amid security deployment and restrictions against the Palestinians. Clashes broke out at the Bab al-Amud, known also as the Damascus Gate, multiple times ahead of the march. Dozens of Palestinians were wounded and arrested by the Israeli forces.
Israel is conducting a very dangerous policy. They are trying to impose the annexation of East Jerusalem, which presents a very serious violation of international law. The only way to stop the Israelis is to resist their actions, but also it is required from the whole international community to impose sanctions on Israel.
At the same time, Palestinians held counter-rallies across the occupied territories, waving the Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. In Ramallah, the protesters said although the Al-Quds is occupied by Israel and surrounded by military checkpoints, it will always remain their eternal capital, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always be a Muslim sacred site.
By allowing the settlers to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the Israeli regime is trying to divert attention from its internal conflict and shift attention to the Judaization of Al-Quds. But it will fail because Al-Quds always unites all the Palestinian people. Today, we're all united for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Ahead of the march, in the morning, some 2,500 settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in groups of 40 to 50 under the protection of Israeli forces. Following that, Palestinian worshippers were attacked and forced out of the compound by the regime forces.
Some around the world could argue that it's only a flag parade and nothing more. But for Palestinians, the flag march is one ugly face of Israel's occupation, domination, and seizure of their right to exist on their homeland. For Palestinians, Al-Quds is a red line, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
It was planned as a friendly soccer match, but turned into a political dispute. Canada has unilaterally pulled out of a World Cup warm-up match it had planned with Iran on June 5th in Vancouver. Citing, quote, untenable geopolitical situation of hosting Iran, the Canadian footballing body Canada Soccer called off the match, which had sold 40,000 tickets already. Here in Iran, the move has created a whirlwind, with Iranian sports authorities calling it illegal and unsporting.
Sportsmanship and fairness is a fundamental principle in sports. Canada's decision to unilaterally cancel the fixture violates the principle. On the other hand, the move has tarnished Canada's image on the world's athletic stage, because no one would trust a country that has apathetically scrapped a formal contract.
The Iranian team was slated to arrive in Canada on Wednesday to take part in the exhibition match. Canada Soccer had said it chose Iran because the team had a similar playing style to Morocco, one of Canada's opponents in the Qatar FIFA World Cup. But aside from missing this rare chance, Canada Soccer now has to pay the financial costs of the sold-out tickets.
It seems that Canada's unilateral cancellation of its match with Iran will produce more long-term ripple effects, as there are financial dimensions to it, not to mention the legal ramifications. Iran has now decided to sue Canada for breach of contract and, quote, politicizing sports.
Canada Soccer backtracked from holding the fixture days after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau criticized the federation for their decision to invite Iran. Tehran says this further reveals how Canada's sport is influenced by political decisions.
It's a pity that a country like Canada, which claims to be committed to the separation of politics from sports, so openly disregards this principle and mixes up political hostilities against Iran with sport. It's definitely a violation of the FIFA regulations.
Tehran has now warned of legal consequences. Iranian sports authorities say they're arranging their complaint to FIFA to seek at least $10 million in damages.
Our colleagues at the Iranian Football Federation are following up on the legal pursuit of the case. We are currently writing to the Canadian Soccer Association to seek a convincing answer regarding why they committed such a move. We will then take the case to FIFA to seek psychological and financial compensation for Canada's illegal action.
Iran says it will move forward with its lawsuit against Canada's Soccer Association to question its eligibility to host 2026 FIFA World Cup. So it seems Canada's costly decision is unfolding into many unthought-of consequences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment